And welcome. I'm Dr. Mona Kula, and this is To Immunity and Beyond. I'm a medically trained doctor and nutrition and health coach, and I love helping people find the very best version of themselves. This show is all about living well, feeling well, and most importantly, aging well. The immune system is essentially the body's wellness system, so by understanding and supporting it, we can all reach an optimal level of health. I'll be having conversations with a wide range of experts from around the world on all the areas that can support our immune system to help us live healthier for longer. Let's live life better. Hi and welcome to Immunity and Beyond. Today I'm talking to Dr. Andrew Jenkinson, bariatric surgeon and author of Why We Eat Too Much, The New Science of Appetite. After reading Andrew's book, I knew I wanted to speak to him about it, so it's a real pleasure to have him joining me today. We discuss obesity as a disease, but also as a pandemic in its own right, and dive into the science behind some of the driving factors behind it, including leptin resistance. We talk about insulin, cortisol, and what the weight set point is, and finish off with practical ways to address these issues so that you can gain back control of your weight. If you're someone who has struggled with their weight over a long period of time, or tried every diet going only to find that the weight you lose comes back with a vengeance, then I really think you'll find this conversation interesting and useful. Thank you very much for being my guest today, Andrew. I wonder if we could start by just finding out a little bit more about how you ended up in bariatric surgery, because it's quite a specialised area and sort of subspecialty within surgery, isn't it?
Yeah, well, thanks for the invitation to speak today, Mona. It was sort of a little bit fortuitous, really. So I was training in stomach and gallbladder and, you know, upper GI laparoscopic surgery at the Royal London, actually, and got quite good at laparoscopic surgery, and then had to look for consultancy jobs. And a job came up at the Homerton Hospital in Hackney, with a colleague that I'd sort of interacted with a few times in conferences, and we got on really well. So I took that job because I wanted to stay in London because my family was here. And that job actually involved quite a lot of bariatric. They had a thriving bariatric unit there. So I sort of got onto the learning curve of learning, you know, bariatric surgery there and then. Pretty steep learning curve. It's quite complex surgery at first. So I spent the first 2 or 3 years really getting proficient at a gastric bypass and the other operations. And I found myself, my practice being sort of taken over by bariatric surgery. So probably 80% of it is now bariatrics and 20% is other things, gallbladder hernia, anti-reflux. So and that sort of threw me into the sharp end of just seeing and speaking to people with obesity that I, you know, hadn't really had much interaction with before.
I've heard you speak before about perhaps prejudices you held yourself against people who were overweight. How did that start to change the way you saw obesity as a disease?
So I think everyone who sees obesity in the traditional way of being due to primarily and only calories in and calories out, and that actually the human, the person, is in control of that. If that is our, you know, conventional understanding of obesity, then by definition, people should have some control over their weight. They should be able to, you know, go on a diet and go to the gym and lose weight and keep it off. Following on from that, if you can't do that, then you must have some problem with, must be either be choosing to be obese or you have some problem with poor willpower. So in a way, if you think of obesity in a conventional way, by definition, you're going to be prejudiced and against obese people. So that was my understanding of obesity when I first started doing these clinics. But so many patients had similar stories and they wanted such drastic surgery. And they just felt as if they were really stuck. They were sort of stuck and trapped within a fat body and they just couldn't fight them their way out, no matter how hard they tried, no matter what type of different fat diets or dietitians or nutritionists they saw. No matter their intelligence, they just couldn't get out of this condition, disease that they found themselves in. So my sort of perception of it changed. Why would someone come to want their stomach removed or bypassed if it was so simple? And clearly it wasn't that simple. And there was something, you know, physiological going on that mainstream doctors and medics didn't yet understand. So that's why I was sort of inspired to be, you know, go to various different conferences on metabolism and weight regulation, physiology, and just, you know, be immersed in recent papers and research. So, and I spent about 5 years researching it before I wrote the book. I actually was doing a load of lectures to GPs and they kept telling me, you need to write a book about this.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was the inspiration for the book.
When patients come to you for bariatric surgery, they'd obviously been through their own journey of trying to lose weight, perhaps losing it and putting it back on. Potentially they'd seen their GP and tried various medications and other things. When they then come to you, do you or did you give them another way to try and lose weight before going through to surgery? Or was that very much, that was the end of their road or their journey and that was the only next step?
So for the NHS patients, all patients have to go through what is called a tier three lifestyle and education program. So this is sort of like a diet, a supervised diet by a GP or a team. So they all have to go through that for 6 months before they qualify to be considered for bariatric surgery. If they've never tried a diet before, then they need to go through that that process. The thing is, quite a lot of those programs, they would just be included. If you've been to Weight Watchers or Slimmers World for 6 months, that would be sort of included and be okay that you've tried. But if you understand sort of end-stage obesity and leptin resistance, then you would sort of understand that even if they did change their lifestyle, they're not going to lose, you know, an adequate amount of weight to get healthy again. So this is where, when you've got really severe obesity, bariatric surgery does play a part. Now, the book was inspired to stop people who are overweight going on low-calorie diets and making basically disrupting their metabolism and making them obese. So that's the book's sort of aimed at overweight. But once someone becomes really morbidly obese, obviously lifestyle changes are great to maintain weight loss after you've had bariatric surgery.
I see. So there's a point at which actually even changing lifestyle, diet, nutrition and various other factors, the obesity's got to that point where it's very difficult to reverse the hormonal changes that have occurred.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this condition called leptin resistance, which is explained in the book, is a real disruption of the signaling between fat and the weight control center in the brain, the hypothalamus.
So was there a standout patient or a particular moment that made you think, actually, I really want to look more into what's going on behind all of this? Or was it just a very gradual thing as you met more and more patients with the same sort of story?
Pretty much gradual, actually. I mean, the book describes a woman, the introduction to the book describes a woman coming into the bariatric department and, you know, explaining all her dietary failures and this being a bit of an inspiration for, you know, for the book. But it was, you know, hundreds of patients just like her that all had really, really similar stories. And as mentioned in the book, I mean, these statements that they say just come up again and again. And you can predict it. You can say, I will say to my medical student, you know, this is what this patient's going to say. They've been on a diet, they can lose weight, but then the weight plateaus as their body adapts to the diet. And then when they resume normal eating again, they regain weight and more. And it's always the same. They always say that. And many patients will say the other things. They think they've got a low metabolism compared to other people they live with, or that they think it's, you know, genetically inherited, that their family suffers with obesity. So all of these things, you know, go against the conventional simplified understanding of obesity being, you know, a problem with too many calories in and not enough calories expended. Yeah, that is the ultimate. But actually, the hypothalamus is the thing that's in control of those, you know, how many calories you take in and expend.
And you talk about the weight set point in your book. That's really the linchpin of the whole concept of losing weight or changing your weight set point in a healthy way. I don't think many people have really heard of that or believe in it. Could you give me an easy to understand explanation of what the weight set point is and why we have one?
So basically, the theory of the weight set point has been gaining traction in quite a few scientific circles. And I'd certainly listened to a lecture a couple of times in this sort of this theory. The thing about the weight set point theory is it totally explains exactly what patients experience. So, I mean, that's, you know, quite compelling. It suggests that everyone has their own individual weight setting where your hypothalamus, which is the thing that controls your weight, wants your weight to be. And that can be set at normal weight, overweight, or obese. And it's determined by, it's actually 75% determined by, you know, genetic predisposition. But the rest of it is determined by your environment. So if you're genetically predisposed and you happen to be in an environment which has got a Western sort of way of living, so Western type of food and also Western type of stress and other things to do with the Western. So cortisol and insulin effects of the way of living in a Western society. So all of those things, if they're combined together, your environment and your genes, it could be that your weight set point is set at obese, okay? And it could be actually that, you know, the more you diet and the more you try and forcibly reduce weight, the higher the weight set point goes to protect you against this perception that you keep going through famines. And a sort of analogy would be you're anchored to that set point. So like if you imagine you're in a ship in the sea and you put the anchor down, you're anchored if you're far out to sea in an obese sea. Now, you can drift up and down in your weight, but you're sort of anchored to a particular area. So you can go on a diet and drift down a little bit by 5, 10, 15 kilograms, but you're always going to be pulled back up by that anchor. This explains why diets don't work in the long run. They do work in the short term. And how to actually change your weight set point. So actually, you know, go away from being moored in the sort of ocean of obesity back towards normal weight by changing these environmental sort of signals to your body.
I think it's such an important message, actually, because there is so much about energy balance and it boiling down to the first law of thermodynamics, you know, energy in versus energy out, and that's all it is. And
yeah, so basically, I mean, the first law of thermodynamics, which obviously is the amount of energy stored within an object, including a human, is the amount of energy taken in by food minus the amount of energy expended by movement, but also our basal metabolism. So, you know, the amount of energy that eats our body, our heartbeat, our breathing, these things, our chemical reactions, our immune system. And that basal metabolism that we can't see accounts for 70% of our energy expenditure, so the amount of that energy that we burn. And that the book explains how dynamic that is. And this is something that's not really mainstream at all. So it can be shrunk down. So for instance, you may have a basal metabolism of, for someone your size, maybe 12 or 1500 kilocalories a day. So if you stayed in bed all day, you would expend that. But that can be shrunk down quite significantly by 300 or 400 kilocalories a day if you start starving yourself. So this is why many patients who I see have been through those really low calorie, ultra low calorie, 800 kilocalories a day diets, and they lose good weight, but then they come to a plateau and they're complying with the diet. They're absolutely starving, ravenous, and, you know, fantasizing about food and really, really sluggish and irritable because their body's trying to stop them burning energy. And the body has just adapted to the weight loss by, you know, shrinking down that basal metabolism. So sort of 800 kilocalories a day is a bit extreme, but a lot of people do 1,200 kilocalories a day and they lose weight, but actually then they don't lose anymore. And they'll go to their GP and their GP won't understand this metabolic, you know, the dynamic regulation of our metabolism in order to defend against weight loss too far away from our weight set point. You know, the anchor is pulling, you know, this is what that metabolic regulation is. So even a GP will say, well, you must be sneaking food in. So I'm not surprised that social media don't understand it either. But the two crucial parts of the book are this weight set point theory. So your weight is anchored at a particular area. It can drift up and down. And it's anchored by this dynamic metabolism that we have. So actually, you know, when most people overeat in the Western world, and if we calculated exactly how much weight people should be putting on, because we're eating 500 kilocalories more now than we were 30 years ago, we should all be putting on, you know, I think it's something like 10, 15 stone a year.
Which obviously doesn't happen.
Which doesn't happen. And the way we burn it off is by increasing our heart rate, our blood pressure, our warmth, and convection of heat away from us. And this is why Western populations suffer with high blood pressure. And then conversely, then when we try and take a proportion of that population are obese and say, okay, you've got to starve yourself to get down to be acceptable to the rest of society, their metabolism is going to adapt. So these people will have a low heart rate. They will have a, you know, parasympathetic nervous system excess. So they will be, you know, bradycardic, low blood pressure, feel cold, and just be very, very sluggish and slow thinking. And that's the way the metabolism just shrinks.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So just to summarize the calories in, calories out, because I think that can be quite a divisive topic.
Basically, it is. So to summarize it, that is the ultimate, okay? You can shut someone in a prison cell or a boot camp, starve them and put them on a treadmill and they will lose weight. But any modicum of free will, because it's not only the dynamic metabolism, you know, shrinking when you lose weight or when you starve yourself, but also these hormones that give you a voracious appetite. So obviously when you're in a prison cell or a boot camp and there is no food there, then you're gonna lose that weight. You can feel quite unwell. But actually, if you're in an environment where there is, I don't know, a Costa or a Tesco's or whatever around, you're going to be driven by your hormones to eat, to take calories in.
Sure.
And these hormone signals are very strong. And it's a little bit like, because the hypothalamus obviously deals with the hydration system, so the amount of water in our body as well. The signals are similar. They have, you know, similar strengths. So losing weight by dieting is analogous a little bit by saying, okay, I want to lose 2 kilograms. I'm not going to drink any water. Can you imagine that advice being given? You can lose 2 kilograms, but you're going to be absolutely parched.
Yeah.
You're going to be hardly able to move. And as soon as water is available, you're going to drink it. And this is a similar thing to low-calorie dieting. It is hypothalamically driven, and it is impossible to resist. If your body is telling you to take in calories and the calories are available, long-term, it's impossible to resist. Yeah, you can do it for a couple of weeks, but not long-term.
So essentially, cutting calories, you will lose some weight. Your metabolic rate adapts downwards. The weight loss slows down or stops. The drive to eat and your metabolism means that actually then you will end up just having something, because it's very difficult to fight against those biological signals that are coming in. And yeah. So without addressing your weight set point,
our hormones do control our behavior. It's not free will. Free will that, you know, we become thirsty or hungry. It's not free will that hormones, you know, influence everything, you know. All the different hormones influence our behaviors, so that we're not run on free will. We're run quite a lot on, you know, our hormonal signaling.
So eventually
that's where the confusion comes. It's not free will. It's, you know, you're being controlled.
Absolutely. So eventually that those hormones, that physiology pulls you back to your set point, the point, the weight that your hypothalamus perceives that your body should be at. So we know that obesity has been identified as a major risk factor for severe forms of COVID-19 and death. Do you think that the last year to 18 months of the pandemic has highlighted obesity as a risk factor for disease and death in a new way at all?
Disease and death from COVID, or?
From COVID and potentially highlighted it as a risk factor in general for poor health.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the figures, there certainly is a much higher risk profile if you get coronavirus and you're obese. There's much higher risk you're going to get severely ill and die. And the interesting thing is there's been such a massive government response to this pandemic, which is an infectious disease pandemic, because we're, you know, we're sort of almost hardwired to be very worried about infectious diseases. But we've had a pandemic for the last 20 years. It's the obesity disease pandemic, which has killed and will kill 10 times more people per year than any kind of coronavirus pandemic. The problem is, because governments don't really understand obesity as a disease, and I still think it's a lifestyle choice, they're not interacting, they're not intervening aggressively at all. And it's amazing how aggressively a government can intervene for public health, as we've seen, you know, it being illegal to, you know, go on holiday or, you know, go to the supermarket twice in a day. So governments can act, you know, robustly for public health if they understand the problem. And I think if they understood the obesity crisis and pandemic, if they understood, you know, that it is a health economic crisis that's very, very, very significant, probably more significant than coronavirus, then they would act much more robustly. I mean, my advice would be that they really do need to tax quite heavily processed and fast foods that are metabolically really, really damaging for a large proportion of the population. And if they then pour those taxes into promotion of, you know, fresh foods, so vegetables, meat, fish, dairy products, and the promotion of cooking, and to try and get some food culture back into our society, like, you know, enjoyment of that process of cooking, eating, sharing food, that's actually going to make our population much, much healthier and happier as well. But the problem is, I mean, if that sort of thing happened, then, you know, you wouldn't really need a supermarket, because you wouldn't really be eating all the rubbish food in the middle of the aisles. You would actually be eating the stuff you can get from greengrocers, fishmongers and butchers, or the farmer's market. And the stuff in the middle of the aisles is hedonic food. It's like a drug. It makes us feel happy. So I can't see government intervention happening, but my little way of saying how I think about the obesity crisis.
I think there are two barriers, two perceived barriers. One is that they're going to be going against huge multinational organisations, global corporations, which will be very difficult for them. And the second, I suppose, is they've, despite having imposed the restrictions on socialising and holidays, which are very personal, it's almost that they're scared to take that step in being as personal as to comment on the public's weight and eating habits. It's quite an emotive topic, isn't it?
Well, it seems like, I mean, the argument against, for instance, taxing chocolate or whatever, or sweet drinks, is nanny statism. But hang on, we've had that, you know, totally nanny statism during this public health crisis. We have a public health crisis to do with the quality of the food available to the population and the ruinous effect on a third of the people who, you know, have obesity, are blamed for it, you know, lose their self-confidence because they just don't think they can control their own bodies anymore, and have a poorer quality of life and a shorter life than other people. This is quite a big disease and condition that is being, you know, ignored because people don't understand it. So the crux is, you know, an understanding that it is not, for most people, a lifestyle choice. It is due to the signals the body's getting in response to mainly the quality of the food, but also other things to do with Western society, stress and lack of darkness, so too much light.
And do you think, regardless of the government stance, do you think for the public, seeing that people who are obese have been more at risk of developing COVID severely or even dying from it, do you think that would have filtered through to people in itself to try and lose weight?
Definitely. I mean, I've seen a lot of people coming for bariatric surgery recently. And one of the main things is they put a bit of weight on during lockdown. It's become a real issue. They are properly obese now. And they want to have an operation to reset their weight to a healthier level. And yeah, Boris Johnson obviously suffers with morbid obesity himself and almost died from COVID. And he's trying to sort himself out, but I don't want to be personal, but I guarantee that his weight will be back up towards where it was a couple of years ago in a year. He has a very highly stressful job and things. So this is what happens with dietism. You're going to go running all the time, but then, you know, and you're going to go on this low calorie diet, but then things go back to normal and your weight set point goes back to where the hypothalamus wants it.
With regards to other chronic diseases, there's quite a lot of evidence we're linking obesity and inflammation, and where inflammation can cause obesity and obesity can cause inflammation. And we know that inflammation, or chronic low-grade inflammation, is a driver for many chronic diseases. Is that the main reason that people who are obese are therefore at a greater risk of chronic diseases?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of vicious circle in that anyone who, the more fat cells that you develop, the more the fatter you get, the higher the level of this inflammatory sort of enzyme TNF-alpha. And that drives, you know, lots of Western diseases, but also drives obesity, because that interferes with hypothalamic signaling of leptin, which is, you know, the underlying cause of obesity, leptin resistance. So this is the thing that once you become properly obese, once you're 18, 20, 25 stone, you have leptin resistance. And this is the reason you are driven to eat all the time. You're ravenously hungry. It's embarrassing. You have to probably binge on your own or in secret. And you just think that you're like a horrible, greedy person. But actually, you're being driven to do that because of this condition called leptin resistance. So basically, our fat cells are supposed to regulate themselves. They're supposed to regulate so they don't sort of get out of control. And if there's too much food in the environment, everyone blows up. So each fat cell produces this hormone called leptin, which goes into the bloodstream and which is signaled to the hypothalamus and signals, you know, how much fat we have in our bodies. Okay, so it's a little bit like the petrol tank meter in our car. So we can see the tank is full or it's on empty. And this is what the hypothalamus is sensing, depending on the level of leptin. If it's high, then it knows that we've got a load of fat on board and it can relax. It can say, well, we're not going to drive appetite. And actually, we're going to burn off a little bit more energy because we've got excess. We just come back from holiday, we're fine. If it goes low, if the signal goes low in the hypothalamus because the leptin levels are low, it's sort of thinking that gives a signal that, you know, your energy results are running a little bit low. Let's turn up the appetite hormones and turn down the metabolism. So let's get a little bit more energy in. And this is the signal, leptin signal. Leptin stops working when there's too much, well, two reasons. First is when there's too much insulin around. So insulin and leptin have the same receptor in the hypothalamus, so the same door that they use. If there's too much insulin, then despite there being a lot of leptin in the blood, it's not sensed by the hypothalamus. And again, if there's a lot of inflammation in the body, that can interrupt the amount of the leptin signal that gets through to the hypothalamus, because it's a little bit like when you're driving along the motorway, the M1 in your car, and you see that the petrol gauge is on empty, everything's flashing, and you sort of panic a bit and you've got to get to the next petrol station, and you fill up. As you start to fill up, you realize the gas tank's full, and actually the problem is the gas tank meter. And this is the problem with leptin resistance. It's a little bit like that faulty meter. So the messages are not getting through, which is why when you have like severe obesity, you're too much insulin, too much inflammation, the leptin signal's not being read. And in fact, the hypothalamus is reading that there is hardly any leptin around. It's actually reading the signal that you're on empty, which is why people with end-stage obesity are driven to eat large amounts hypothalamically, and they're driven to feel tired all the time. So they're driven to, you know, act like they're lazy. These are hormonal signals to do with leptin resistance. They're not character traits. This is why it's so fascinating to start to understand obesity and our misconceptions of it. But leptin resistance is, you know, a crucial thing to understand, I think.
And is leptin resistance something that builds up gradually over time? Is there a genetic component to it? Can it come on very suddenly?
It's something that's actually, we can't diagnose. There is no test for it, but we know that it works normally. We know that in individuals who have this really rare genetic disorder where they just never produce any leptin from their fat cells, these people become, you know, 20 stone by the time they're 10 years old. But we also know when we inject those people with leptin, they get the signal and they lose a load of weight. But if we have someone who is normal, doesn't have that rare genetic abnormality and they're obese and we inject them with leptin, nothing happens because they've already got a load of leptin. It's just not working. Yeah. But there's no actual test for it. But we just sort of know from the research that, you know, they have leptin there, but it's just not working. It's leptin resistance. I don't think there's any evidence that it can particularly come on overnight. I think it's something that just develops the more obese you get. But it's interesting that I think a big driver of leptin resistance is insulin. And this is why things like a ketogenic diet or low-carb dieting, they will alter your insulin levels. So if you cut down on sugar and refined carbohydrates sort of overnight, your insulin level is going to decrease substantially. But all of a sudden, your leptin is being seen by your hypothalamus. So this is why, you know, low-carb diets, they're not going away because they do work.
Once you have leptin resistance then through lifestyle and nutritional changes, can you reverse that fully, or would you always have an element of that there?
I think probably it can be reversed fully in time. You see, the problem is once you're leptin resistant, you're getting these signals to, you know, consume food, and you're getting like ravenous signals to just get calories in, and you go across to Tesco's or whatever supermarket's around, you will go to that bad food, which is going to trigger a load of insulin in your body, and that's going to make the thing worse. So actually, if you understand it, I mean, you may be getting the ravenous signals, but if you actually say, okay, I'm going to actually try and avoid sugar and refined carbohydrates, that food, I'm going to eat because I'm starving, but I'm going to eat different food. You will get these people who are really struggling with leptin resistance, are really quite obese. If they give up sugar and wheat, they actually lose quite a lot of weight quite fast just by that, you know, reset of the leptin signal.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So for people listening who perhaps have struggled with dieting, reducing calories, losing weight, then gaining it back, perhaps then putting even more on, the message is really that they need to start to address their weight set point, because by bringing that down gradually, then their weight will reduce to match that. There are so many factors involved in this, as I know from having read your book. What are the main things people can do to start to address their weight set point and bring it to a better place for them?
So there are three main sort of internal factors that we need to change. So the first one is insulin. You can sort of see food as almost like a proxy drug. If you have that type of Western food with a lot of sugar in, it's almost like indirectly you're giving yourself insulin. And as you know, Manya, if I started treating you with insulin, you would seamlessly probably put on 2 stone in weight. You know, weight set point would be changed. And then if I stop treating you with insulin, your weight set point would go back to where it is now. And the same with me. Food acts as a proxy drug giving you the insulin. It's sort of like an indirect way of giving you insulin. So that's the first thing, insulin. The second thing to change, and we'll go on to how to change them in a minute. The second thing to change is cortisol. I think there's a lot of evidence that high cortisol levels cause a higher weight set point. And again, as you know, if I treat you with hydrocortisone for some autoimmune disease, you know, in a year, you'd be 2 stone heavier, and the same with me. And then if we withdrew that treatment, you would lose weight again. And cortisol is high in people who have highly stressed personal or work lives. And it's also affected by a lack of sleep and a lack of melatonin. So that's the second thing, cortisol. If we can reduce that, we can reduce weight set point. The third factor that I think is crucial is the relationship between the omega-3 and the omega-6 fatty acids. And again, it's a hypothesis, but I think it fits in with a lot of the epidemiology out there. The fact that obesity started in the 1980s when we started eating less saturated fat and much more vegetable oils. Vegetable oils give us a massive overdose of omega-6. Omega-6 is inflammatory and, you know, has that effect on the hypothalamus as well. So addressing that omega-3-6 ratio. So those three things, insulin, cortisol, and omega-3-6 ratio. So I think there's 5 steps to go through. The first is obviously to give up sugar and refined carbohydrates. That's actually quite difficult because you're going to get, you know, we all have this hedonic addiction to sugar. It makes us feel great. So it'd be the same as giving up cigarettes or alcohol. You're going to feel a bit empty for a while. But that's the first step. The second step was to try and de-stress, unpick family and work stresses, and to promote your home to a better sleeping environment. Again, looking into the effect of melatonin on cortisol. The third thing was to take up an activity that you actually enjoy and is sustainable. So if you don't like the gym, there's no point in getting gym membership. If you like the gym, get gym membership. But if you prefer to go and play tennis or squash or badminton or go swimming, you know, do that instead. And if you can sort of remain active 2 or 3 times a week, that's going to be good. And that sort of, people will say, well, that's, you're contradicting yourself, because that's a way of just expending, you know, calories. And you just said that isn't the main thing. But actually, the way that exercise works, I think, is by improving insulin sensitivity. So the more you exercise, the fitter you get, the less insulin, or the more effective the insulin that you have is. So you need less of it. And also, exercise will decrease your cortisol and stress hormones. So both of those things, so exercise, you know, has a really good effect on both insulin and cortisol.
And is there something there as well about maintaining your muscle, your lean muscle tissue?
Yeah. So if you're really, really sedentary, you get this thing called sarcopenia, where basically your muscles are sort of wasting away a little bit. And we know from quite a lot of research that, you know, muscle metabolism is really important for that metabolic regulation.
Yeah.
So that was the first three things. The fourth thing is to try and optimize that omega-3-6 profile. And basically, the food that has omega-3 is fresh foods, you know, greens, animals and fish that have eaten greens, so grass-fed cattle, fish that have been in the sea that have been eaten algae and not in a fish farm. They have great omega-3. Omega-6 is, you know, a wash in vegetable oils. So if you throw away your vegetable oils and start actually cooking in saturated fat instead, which is actually much less heart risky than people perceive. Saturated fat from dairy and animals is less risky than is perceived by most people. And particularly if combined with a lifestyle that includes exercise and activity, I mean, that's massively protective against any type of heart disease, because the good cholesterol, the HDL, goes up. So people shouldn't, I don't think, be avoiding, you know, red meat and dairy products and replacing them with grains. But this is what caused the obesity crisis in the first place, you know, going away from saturated fat and towards refined carbohydrates. This causes high insulin level and leptin resistance and obesity in the population.
Yeah.
And going to the other point, the essential fatty acid, the omega-3 and 6 is, yeah, if the cattle are grass-fed or the fish are, eat algae, so they're sea fish, rather than farmed fish and farmed cattle who will eat sort of grains, then the proportion of the omega fatty acids will be much healthier as well in those foods.
We have one more point left. So we've done insulin, cortisol.
The third one was de-stressing and rest.
Yep.
Yeah, sleeping better. The fourth one was obviously, so the way that you can optimize your omega-3-6 ratio would be to, you know, buy fresh foods, you know, avoid processed foods, avoid food with vegetable oils in them. Don't cook with vegetable oil, throw it away. Don't have takeaways, because they just infused with fast food is infused with vegetable oils. And if you eat just fresh foods and cook it yourselves, you're going to optimize your omega-3-6 ratio much better. And over time, that is actually going to have like a really positive effect on your insulin signaling and your weight. So that was the fourth thing. The fifth thing was going back towards the insulin. So the first step was to give up, to just the simple process of giving up sugar and refined carbohydrates. So it's quite simple. The fifth step would be to look at the carbohydrates in the relatively healthy diet that you're now eating and say, okay, I want to reduce them a little bit more. So basically be aware of the amount of rice and potatoes or vegetable containing carbohydrates that you're eating. And we sort of, as a population, I think we consume about 300 grams of carbohydrates or sugar a day, trying to get that down towards 100 grams and then towards maybe 80 and then towards 60. So basically doing something that's going to reduce your insulin level but not make you ketogenic. So ketogenic means that, you know, you've run out of sugar and you're running on ketone bodies, but actually that's not really sustainable for most people because you get like a massive carbohydrate craving and it's just eventually you're going to cave in and put all the weight back on. It's a really sustainable way of cutting down on carbohydrates that, you know, shouldn't be too onerous and should have a really positive effect on your weight.
And there are people who might argue that this effectively is a low carbohydrate type of diet in that case. I mean, we don't want to demonize carbs either, do we? So is it a case of managing that depending on what your own goals and results are?
Yeah, I mean, if you do a lot of exercise, then you can eat more carbohydrates, I think. And the thing about the first five steps, I mean, it's made clear, and the publishers told me to put something in at the end where there would be some advice for readers. I didn't really want to do that. But actually, it sort of really makes sense. I really thought about it quite hard. So basically, it's a stepped plan where, you know, the first thing is easy. Then, so giving up sugar and refined carbohydrates should be relatively easy. That's going to have a major effect on your weight if you have too much bread, for instance. And then you can do whatever steps you want. Or stop whenever you want. So you don't have to, you know, you can stop at the second or third or fourth step. So the fifth step is the final step, which, yeah, some people may say is a little bit like a diet. But no, I think a diet is a short-term thing. I mean, this should be something that is a total change in the way you eat forever. So you shouldn't perceive it as a diet. It's just you're eating differently.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with that. How do you feel, Andrew, that we can get this message out to people? Because there's still so much conflicting advice out there, isn't there? Especially with the calories in, calories out that we spoke about earlier. It's very difficult to convince people about the benefits of actually changing the foods that they eat, looking at their insulin, looking at cortisol, stress, sleep, looking at the whole package, buying fresh produce, because people just want a quick fix, don't they?
They do, but I think the ideas in the book are slowly gaining traction. It's really popular. We're getting reviews every week. It's been in the audio bestsellers now for a while. It's still in the Amazon, you know, top 20 bestsellers a year and a half after publication. I get lots and lots of emails and queries and things. So it's slowly gaining some traction. People who are interested in this area of science and wellness are aware of it. And people who suffer with obesity, many of them are aware of it, but it hasn't as yet seeped up to the higher echelons of power. I actually sent Boris Johnson a copy of the book with a letter, but I didn't get any response. And I've got a colleague who is well connected, and he said he's going to give a copy to Matt Hancock and a couple of other guys. But yeah, we'll see.
I mean, I think it's fantastic, and it's exactly the information that people in government need to take on board and understand to facilitate any sort of policy change or just a change in the guidance that they are giving out to the public.
So one, they're slightly reliant on, well, they're influenced by lobbyists from the food industry. And I think they're aware that food does make people happy. You know, this is why people got through the coronavirus crisis, because they've just been on takeaways and Netflix. You know, they're okay. This is like, we're saving lives. Fantastic. I'm just going to stay and watch Netflix and get a pizza and feel great about myself, you know. So I think the government are aware, all governments for centuries are aware that, you know, if a population is well fed, you know, or they feel that they're well fed, they're sort of happier. So to tackle that hedonic aspect of food, I think is something that they are reluctant to do. Even if they understood it, they might be reluctant to do it. But we will see what happens.
I think it's a great book, and I've been telling everybody about it. my own background, I think this is why I identified so strongly with it. I struggled with my weight through all of my early adult life, and I was that person who yo-yo dieted. I would get quite skinny, then I'd get fatter than I was before. I tried every different fad diet going. I'd be starving myself. I'd exercise to the point of I'd be in zero calories for the day because I'd exercise so much to offset my food. And after having two children and because I was focused on them, I wasn't able to do the exercise, and I ended up at 18 stones, which, I mean, I'm 5'11", so I'm not saying that that's acceptable, but I was
It's a normal story. It's a totally normal story. Yeah.
And so I started to do a bit of my own research, and I ended up at a local gym where I had a personal trainer, and he just had a very different view, very similar to yours, on how to lose weight. And it was the first time I'd ever looked at food differently, and I completely changed how I ate, what I ate. I started doing strength training, which I enjoy, so that works for me. And I realized when I read your book that what I had done was I changed my weight set points over a period of a couple of years.
Yeah.
And I've been this size, which I'm happy with, for 7 or 8 years now, and I don't ever count anything. I just eat.
So as you changed what you eat, basically. Yeah.
I don't even think about it anymore, and I just stay at this weight. And for me to be at this age, I imagined myself being much, much bigger because of how big I was in my 20s and early 30s. So I know
if you tried the usual diets, you know, you would have been heavier than 18 stone by now.
Exactly.
And frustrated with yourself, yeah.
And I mean, this is another topic, isn't it? The message that you give to your children about eating and nutrition. And so I grew up with that same mentality of, you've got to starve yourself, not, you know, can't eat, count all your calories. And and actually now that I've learned everything that I've learned, I see how counterproductive that is. And so that's why I think I identified with your book so strongly, because having been through that journey, I know it really does work. And it's, and actually freeing, it gives you freedom, because nobody wants to spend their life counting calories or worrying that they can't eat when they go out, you know, enjoy their meal. Because if everything else is balanced and you eat well and do the right things the rest of the time, your body just naturally regulates itself.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the steps in the book are designed to, like, not be some terrible, you know, changing your lifestyle where, you know, it's not very nice anymore. It should be something that actually makes your quality of life better. So doing a bit of exercise that you like, or activity that you like, you know, going to sleep a bit earlier maybe, and cooking, you know, and maybe just getting full up, working up an appetite and not snacking, you know, and really enjoying your food when you get it.
Yeah.
So yeah, all these things should, going back to sort of, you know, the times before there was an obesity crisis, you know, like 50, 60, 70 years ago of, you know, sort of a slightly more old-fashioned way of eating and maybe living.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. So, and as you mentioned, there are other benefits that come with that, aren't there? Because you will feel more energetic, you know, less prone to aches and pains, potentially, through reduced inflammation. And I think just, I don't know, I mean, I'm much more energetic now than I was 10 years ago. And I think that's because I eat healthy food and I exercise and I sleep much better. Stress is something I am not quite as good at addressing.
You've got the kids and the media career, so yeah.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed that conversation, Andrew. Thank you. There's actually so much more I'd love to talk about, because I would love to dissect every part of that book with you. But I think for the purposes of
time, if you want to follow up on any time, that's cool. Yeah.
No, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Good. Okay.
Lovely.
Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. And you.
Cheers, Mona. Bye.
Okay. Bye bye. Thank you so much for listening today, and I really hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Do follow me on Instagram at thehealthspandoctor for information on the show, as well as recipes and health and nutrition advice. Until next week, let's live life better.